This is Hometown Heroes. Honoring everyday Americans who answer the call of duty.
Welcome back to Hometown Heroes. I hope that you were as moved by hearing Frank Rego tell his story as I was to sit with him there in his home in Phoenix. A reminder of some of the things that so many of us take for granted. In his case, it was the use of his legs that he lost. In the case of thousands of Americans who became prisoners of war in World War II, it was the temporary loss of that precious gift of freedom that so changed their perspective. And one of the most powerful POW stories you're ever going to hear is coming to the big screen this Christmas. Unbroken is due out in theaters Christmas Day. And next week on Hometown Heroes, to get you in the spirit for that, we're going to revisit my interview with the late Louis Zamperini, the man whose true story inspired that film. I'm looking forward to sharing that with you. But for the rest of the program today, we're going to hear about a place that brings history alive in a really powerful way, way out in West Texas. You know, I travel a lot to announce sporting events on the radio, and believe it or not, I had more hiccups and challenges on a trip to Lubbock, Texas and back than I've had, I think, in the last 5 years combined. Delays, cancellations, missing bags, an all-night Greyhound bus ride complete with a crying baby behind me. Yeah, no lie. But one of the things that made it all worth it was a chance to visit the Silent Wings Museum, which preserves the history of the glider program in World War II. If you're a longtime listener to Hometown Heroes, you've heard from men who piloted those powerless gliders on D-Day and in other invasions. You've heard from guys who flew the C-47s that towed them, and men who were passengers in those gliders ready to jump out and fight the enemy when they landed. It was a revolutionary idea at the time, but it's a facet of World War II that many people remain unaware of today. If you visit the city-owned Silent Wings Museum in Lubbock, Texas, you'll learn all about it. And that's what we're going to do right now with Eddie Grigsby, the assistant museum's manager. He took me on a grand tour, pointing out all the displays, even the gorgeous watercolors of glider scenes. And who were they painted by? A longtime Disney animator, Dale Oliver, who had been a glider pilot in World War II. All kinds of different facets to this, and the museum really captures a great snapshot of how World War II impacted everybody in all walks of life. But let's start by asking Eddie what he gets out of it working at the Silent Wings Museum every day.
For me, it's the enjoyment and the satisfaction of doing something that preserves, you know, we have our history that we have. I take care of a museum that has one of the largest collections of the World War II Military Glider Pilots Association. They have entrusted us with carrying on and showing and talking and telling about their legacy and what they did during the war.
You've taken me through the museum. I've seen a lot of the different displays here, and it's very impressive. It's all state-of-the-art. It's up-to-date. It's sharp-looking. What impresses you the most as you see the different displays and manage them, and you hear the stories from these veterans, and you understand what all they did during World War II? What kind of takes you back and says, wow, that's impressive?
Well, for me, it's the CG-4A, the glider, that because they had it on display at their museum when it was at Terrell, and they're the ones who actually did the complete restoration of it. And that's quite an undertaking. I mean, they've probably got 5,000 to 6,000 hours of just labor of work from them putting that thing together and putting it in the kind of condition that it's in now.
And how'd that happen that the museum came here to Lubbock? I know that this was a huge training area during the war for Silent Wings, for glider pilots and glider infantry and all that. But how did it actually become a city-owned museum here in Lubbock?
Well, the Glider Pilots Association, when they originally opened in Terrell, Texas in 1984, the museum operated there. They started to look and realize that they needed to find more of a permanent home for it, especially as they were getting a little bit older, and they just needed someone to be the caretakers for. And they approached a couple of entities, which City of Lubbock was one. There's a museum in Atlanta that they approached, and also the museum in New Orleans. And the City of Lubbock, we worked out a deal with them. Reason being is about the glider pilots. There was 6,000 of them that were trained, and about 80% came through Lubbock. So a lot of them had a tie here to Lubbock. They've been through. And it also brought back some of our history back to Lubbock. It brought back a time when the city had a lot of growth during the war effort. The base was here from 42 to 45. And it just brought a lot of prosperous times. So it was a good fit. They needed someone to look after it, and it was a good fit for the city to get it, to bring it back, and to preserve our history.
I'm sure that was a significant investment on the part of the city. Does it seem like it's been worth it to you? What do you see as the fruits of that investment?
The fruits of investment is we saved a part of our history. This museum also comes back, and it presents a like quality of life issues for the city of Lubbock. We have a world-class museum. Everyone tells us that when we come through that they're really amazed that this is a first-class act museum. And to me, that just adds to the benefit of being a citizen of Lubbock.
I'm sure you've had a chance to interact with some of the glider pilots or the glider infantry, the guys that actually worked in these situations, and you have some scenes that are set out there, some kind of recreations of what these guys would encounter in combat. What's it like to watch those guys who actually lived this 70 years ago come through and take in some of your displays?
It's very pleasing. You know, you do get a little bit of criticism when you come through, because you'll have one of the gentlemen said, well, we got the uniform wrong, or, you know, they'll kind of correct us. But then when you talk to another one, their uniform, they say, no, we're spot on. But we have to realize that not every GI had the same experience. There wasn't enough uniforms to go around, so they were mixing and matching, and they were doing different things. But we just try to stay consistent with a plan, and if someone comes in and they see that we might be off on something, we take that in consideration and we'll correct it. You'd mentioned about the impact of the glider pilot or the rider, and then when you see them walk up to a case and you see them look at their kids and their grandkids and say, that was what I did. And you see their eyes, or you see them come up to a display and they read something and they start to cry. You know, it pulls at your heartstrings. But, you know, it was a tough situation and they did it. And, you know, we're here to try to let people know, the future generations, what these folks did.
Do you ever sit there and watch those moments, or even watch some of the great videos that you guys have here to educate people and to help them learn the history? You ever sit there and say, man, I don't know if I could have done that, to fly a powerless plane or go in with really no defenses, not knowing where I'm going to end up, and then try to fight my way to someplace else where there are more Americans?
I'll be honest with you. You know, I'm a little bit older than they were when they did this. Looking at it now, there was probably no way you could get me to do what they did. It was truly, you had to volunteer for this. It was 100% volunteer to be a glider pilot. And it was the first time in history that a pilot was trained for one-way missions and to be a combat soldier once they were on the ground. They were just a regular foot soldier to regroup, to work their way back across the enemy lines, back into territory, get to a base, to get another glider, to fly another mission. Some of these guys flew several flights in one mission, which is, to me, is amazing. It's just kind of like, ooh, I got shot at. Let me go get some more of that, you know? But they were quite the incredible folks.
And one thing I know you've learned is that some of these guys actually enjoyed those landings, or the fact that they pretty much had to crash that thing to bring it in. And you kind of have a recreation in one of your rooms here of how they could actually use enemy obstructions to their benefit.
Right. There was the item mainly is the Rommel's asparagus. The enemy, the Germans, were very mathematical, and they would put them up in even rolls and cross sections.
And just so everybody knows, this isn't actually asparagus you can eat we're talking about. Tell them what Rommel's asparagus was.
A Rommel's asparagus is probably about a 30-foot pine tree with all the branches cut off, so it's one huge fence post. And probably about 15 feet of that post was buried in the ground, and another 15 feet sticking up top. If you were lucky just to find a field with Rommel's asparagus, they could use that to shear the wings off so they could actually stop quicker in a smaller field. The only time that it was a downside is when they actually mined the tops of some of the asparagus. When they were learning what was going on later, they started actually setting some mines to some of them. That made it more difficult.
And you have basically a recreation of one of those gliders coming in where the wing basically gets torn apart by that big pine tree, but that actually helped them slow down and not topple over or go in head first or have a rougher landing, huh?
Yes. I mean, if they would hit it evenly, it would slow it down. If you hit one on one side, it would spin it around and around. But the whole thing was to try to come in and get your cargo, whether it is a Jeep, a trailer, or 13 infantrymen, get them on the ground, get it safely so it could be used effective.
And you couldn't really practice that kind of landing with those obstructions in the way. These guys were pretty gutty. you also, it's not just veterans and their families that come through here. You get a lot of school tour groups, and I'm sure every school in Lubbock is sending kids here. What kind of moments, light bulb moments, do you see for those kids? And there are some questions maybe that you think back on that say, yeah, it was pretty neat when I got to answer that question or saw the kids putting this and this together.
You know, it's amazing when you see, you know, the kids, we get, you know, all ages. But when they start putting together the Axis and Allied powers, you know, who was who, and then they realize Italy was, you know, part of the Axis powers. It starts to click. You see the history, the stuff that they've been learning, and they start seeing things from the history that just reinforces it. And you get to see that. And there's a lot of, you know, a lot of questions. I still get, you know, I'm in my 40s, and I'll still have some of the younger kids ask me, what did I do during World War II? You know, it's just like, I'm not old enough yet. So
now I can tell my kids I'm not the only one. Thanks for that. Do you have a favorite display or element of this museum that when you're, you know, trying to convince someone to come see it, you're like, oh, you got to come see this?
I would say it's our crown jewel. It's, once again, it's our CG-4A glider. You know, we call it a cargo glider. The CG stands for cargo glider. But if it was used in, it was definitely could be a combat glider, because when you were shot at, but you had no way of returning fire, it was used in all aspects of invasions. But when you start to consider that we have one of seven, when I first started in the museum, we were one of five of gliders complete in the world. We've been helping other museums. We have helped the Glider Trust in Charterhouse, England, put a glider together, and they've been helping us put a Horsa together here, sending us parts and components and blueprints.
I was wondering why I didn't see a Horsa out there, but you guys are actually adding a Horsa.
Right. We have a cockpit and some of the fuselage ribs and stuff that's out there. It's kind of a slow going because we have to use volunteers to help us do woodwork and so forth. But our goal is to get the nose cone and the fuselage, and I probably won't get much more than that because our hangar gallery isn't big enough to have both the Horsa, because it's a huge bird, and the CG-4A on display at the same time.
How often do you have people come in here and it's clear to you that they had no idea this was happening during the war, that these glider invasions were actually taking place, and when they realized how frequent it was, and it wasn't just in Europe, and it was all over the place? How often do you see those people that are just kind of wowed by all of it?
Almost weekly. We'll have someone come through, and they didn't realize that the glider program even existed. Like I said, in the whole mobilization of our forces, you know, you're just talking about 6,000 glider pilots. Some 14,000 gliders were built during the war effort. It was one of those things that there wasn't a lot of press on it, but it was used, like I said, in every major invasion of the war. So it was used to supply, to carry troops, and to also evacuate. We have a whole display on the snatch pickup, to where they actually would fly over and pull one up off the ground out of a combat zone, and you could take out wounded and so forth, evacuate.
Maybe it's commonplace to you now because you've been around the museum long enough, but isn't that a little crazy sounding? I mean, to have a tow plane come in, hook something that doesn't have any power, and yank it on out of there? I mean, it sounds a little crazy, doesn't it?
Oh, yeah. It's, you know, the guys who sat around and thought this up and tried to practice it, but they basically used, you know, 1930s airmail technology, and then added a big winch to the back of a C-47 that kind of fed out a little bit of line at the same time it had drag pulling forward. So if you can think of a big fishing reel kind of letting out but pulling in at the same time, you could just pull it off the ground.
Feel free to add anything else that I haven't asked you about, but I know you guys have something coming up here during the holidays, and maybe some of our listeners in different parts of the country are thinking, hey, this would be a good idea for us to try here in our community. Tell me what you guys do at Christmas time around here at the museum to kind of bring back that spirit of the 1940s.
Well, we have a program that we call the Foxhole Christmas. And it's geared about making Christmas ornaments, decorations, and stuff for your tree out of regular household items or thing that you might find, scraps of metal, different lids from your mason jars and so forth, and what you can do. And the main reason why we focus on that is the whole mobilization of the 1940s is everything was rationed. Everything from rubber to sugar to you name it, there was pretty much a ration on it. And you just couldn't go out and buy something. You had to either use a ration stamp for it, or you just had to wait till you could find somewhere it was used. So we tried to do programs where we do a lot of the home front, where everyone took part, where they were either, once again, using things that weren't not normally used and how to decorate it to make it look like something else so you could actually still have ornaments because you couldn't go out and buy any.
I'm sure a lot of people get a whole lot of perspective from engaging in that, and that makes me wonder about you living this, breathing it every day. How has your immersion in World War II history changed your perspective?
Well, I think for me, I think I'm a lot more, I recycle a lot more. I look at things and I look at other uses instead of just going out and buying something. I hang on to a few things. So I think just learning what they did and then learning, you know, what's around your house and what you can keep recycling, keep reusing. It's I think that's something that I think everyone can actually learn a little bit.
No doubt. And I like that point. It's not just about learning about the past so we can say we know a little more history. It's about applying the lessons of history to our present and to our future. And the Silent Wings Museum is doing a wonderful job of that in Lubbock, Texas. Next week, we'll talk about Unbroken, the movie version of Louis Zamperini's story. It comes out on Christmas Day, and we'll get you ready by listening to Louis himself. We're going to listen to what he thought were the most amazing elements of his story and why it was so important to him to share that story with others. I'm looking forward to that, but we're out of time for now. Thanks for listening to Hometown Heroes today. I'm Paul Leffler, reminding you again that freedom is not free.